Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in applied biotechnology. Discover, research, and thrive in the expanding field of biotech in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This coming Monday evening on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, the public can view an absolutely marvelous film, which is titled American Oz, The True Wizard Behind the Curtain. And I probably don't have to explain that title to anybody. When you hear the word Oz, American Oz and wizard and so on, you know that we are talking about L. Frank Baum and The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the book that got everything started and that created, in a sense, a sprawling and impressive franchise that has made its way into the hearts and lives of children of all ages. And a lot of us who have not been children for a long time still really love this work. And much that has sprung from it. It turns out that the life of L. Frank Baum was complicated. In fact, at some point in the film that we're talking about, Mr. Baum is called a complicated person with a complicated story. And so that story can only be adequately told in a film that does not rush through the story. And so I am so glad that we can talk about this film, American Oz, The True Wizard Behind the Curtain, which airs this coming Monday night on the PBS series American Experience. At the helm, writing and directing and producing this film, Randall McLowry and Tracy Heather Strain, who together have been making films for many, many years with their own company called The Film Posse. They have done a number of works for American Experience, including a film about the early days of Silicon Valley, a film about the Hatfield-McCoy feud. We had a conversation about that. Construction of the Alaska Highway, which I also remember doing an interview about. And you may know them from other work that they have done, including Lorraine Hansberry, Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart, which has some relation to Raisin in the Sun. And other works include Unnatural Causes, Is Inequality Making Us Sick? Again, their latest film for American Experience called American Oz, The True Wizard Behind the Curtain. Randall McLowry and Tracy Heather Strain, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. We're delighted to talk to you.
I'm always enjoy talking to documentarians. For all the things that I do in my life that I love doing, I there are very few people I envy in terms of vocation, but I do envy documentarians because it just seems like the most fascinating kind of work, and especially when you have a beautiful work like this film that will live on after you and will make such a difference in the lives of so many people. So I'm really happy to talk with you. Ahead of us talking about the film specifically, I wonder if I could ask you about what it has been like for you over the last 12 months during the COVID-19 pandemic. There are a lot of people in terms of the work that they do in which that work is either ground to a halt or has been radically altered in terms of how that work is done. Maybe not so much with documentarians. I don't know. I would just be really interested to know how your lives, your professional lives in terms of making films has been affected by the pandemic?
Sure, and thanks for asking that question. It certainly, it did make this project quite different from other films that we have produced in the past. We were actually just embarking on the production part of our production phase for the film back in March of 2020. And with all of the swirling around information about the pandemic happening and how it may impact, you know, things here in the States, we got through the first week of our interview production, filming five interviews, and then everything shut down. So it was basically right in the middle of, we had anticipated doing another full week of shooting. And, the decision was made, partly, we both Tracy and I also are professors at Wesleyan University, and the university itself, shut down and went to virtual for the rest of the semester. And we were in test, we were, creating our schedule around our spring break at that time. And then there was basically, figuring out how do we then continue to move forward, and in conversations with the executives and the team of American Experience at GBH Boston, and really starting to, research how the industry in itself was starting to try to deal with this. And the industry obviously shut down as well. And it was slowly trying to, we had to figure out how to try to do the interviews in a way that was safe. And this really, and so we weren't able to actually start back into interview production for about 3 months.
Wow.
At least we didn't, so middle of March we stopped, and we didn't start doing our next interviews, I think, until maybe it was the end of June, or maybe it had been in July, I think.
I think it was July. And even then, we were still so nervous, and we didn't want to make, we wanted to make sure everybody involved felt comfortable being interviewed, and we no longer went to anybody's home. We had to find locations. We had to set up, sanitation and protocols. And we basically started shooting with just a crew, a small crew, either just a camera person who did sound, or a camera and sound person, and then one other person to help sort of make sure the temperatures were taken and the, all the details of sanitizing, and we did the interviews remotely from Middletown, Connecticut. And so that was new to us, and that was a very different experience. And but we were delighted that most of the people that we originally wanted to interview were available. Some people, unfortunately, could no longer do it for a variety of reasons, which we totally respect. And we were grateful for everybody who worked through this with us.
Right.
And the interview process, took a couple months to actually get through all the rest of the interviews. Typically, we try to do things in a very, condensed period of time. And it was just the logistic of it was much more difficult. And we were in fact filming as we were editing and continuing to edit, so that was, which is not necessarily unusual, but for the amount of material we were constantly trying to, we knew we still had to get to try to fit into the edit was different than other projects.
Right. I'm actually surprised to hear that anybody became unavailable, because this film is wonderfully crowded. That is, I mean that in the best sense of the word, you have a lot of people on hand lending their voices and their perspectives to this story, which I really, really appreciate, including a grandson of Mr. Baum himself, but a plethora of writers who have, and historians as well, who all have very, very interesting things to say about this story. I wonder if you could help us understand, first of all, what you knew about Mr. Baum and his complicated story ahead of taking on this project. I mean, how much of this was a sort of voyage of discovery for the two of you? Or going into this, did you have some sense of at least some of the complexity that was part of this man and his legacy?
Well, I knew nothing about Baum before going in. I'm one of those kids that grew up with a collection of the white books on my shelf. And so I just knew of what I read from those books. And then I carried them around with me until just actually a few years ago when I gave them to someone for their child. So I had the whole series of Oz books, right, on my shelf. So this was exciting to me to look into a creative life. I really enjoy exploring stories of people who create things. And you know, as people who create things, we know typically those journeys aren't easy. And so they tend to be interesting. So that's where I started.
So for me, I also didn't know anything about Baum going into it. My knowledge of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz was actually just the movie. I wasn't, you know, I knew it was based on a book, but I had never read the book or the series at that time. You know, so it was a total immersion into the world of Baum and also, you know, the world of The Wizard of Oz in terms of what was beyond and what was in the film. But when I did find out that, you know, he published the book in 1900, which actually was news to me, I immediately had a sense that this person's life would be spanning a time that was very transformative in American history. And the fact that it came out in 1900, you know, made it very intriguing in terms of what was being said in the book, you know, that would be reflective of that time. And so, but we did learn about, you know, Baum and his complexities, both in terms of sort of his own personal life and sort of the complicated things he was dealing with, and also his, you know, the wonderful aspects of his personality and the sense of reinvention and imagination that really kind of defined who he was and really placed him in a sense of being not only the story being quintessentially American, but also who he was, having these, you know, very foundational American qualities.
Can you give us an idea of how the sort of general arc of this film took place? And I'm asking about this film specifically, I suppose, but in some ways I'm asking maybe a more general question about the process by which an ambitious documentary film like American Oz gets put together. I mean, at the outset, what are the two of you doing? And then at what point does it become clear what kind of a story this is and how it needs to be told?
Yeah, sure. So we start with research. We do secondary source research first. Usually we try to read every book we can find on whatever topic. So every book that was written about L. Frank Baum and The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, we try to gather in one way or another. You know, libraries, there's some libraries that didn't have any Oz books on their shelves for a while, you know. And then from those books, we locate primary sources. We, at the same time, we're looking not just from the books for primary sources, but we start scouring the country, if not the world, to find out, you know, where are papers, where are different items to get the first person information or as much as possible. And so we also had another producer working with us named Rebecca Taylor, and she was the kind of the lead research person combing archives. She traveled to some before the pandemic and started collecting materials. And so but all the time we're having meetings and discussions, and in our office, when we used to go to our office, the Film Posse office, we have the kind of walls you could write on, and we would write down ideas of structure. And, you know, we didn't know if it would work out or not, but we just kept kind of going through it. Does this work? Is this supported? Is this idea supported? And, but we knew there was something to this idea of somebody who knew early on that he had something in him that he wanted to get out, you know, that kind of thing that sometimes people have when they're younger. You could see that he had that. And we were constantly trying to figure out how to present that story. And then I think the other challenge for us is, because he dies before the movie, you know, is released, how do you make sure the film, the arc of the film doesn't die with him dying, you know, so the rest of the film doesn't seem like an afterthought, you know, so that was another challenge for us.
And the one thing I would speak to that I think we knew going in, it was that, you know, what was defining for so many people about The Wizard of Oz is the 1939 film. And that, you know, was really what I think has cemented it in the American popular culture, you know, more so than the book itself. I think, you know, that really is when you see references to the Wizard of Oz and the Man Behind the Curtain, you know, there's, it's bringing, conjuring up ideas from the 1939 film. And for me, I mean, I relate to what a couple of the interviewees say in the beginning about, you know, being stunned when they found out that it was in color also, because I grew up on a black and white TV, and being, you know, terrified by the flying monkeys. But it, there was a lot of discussion about how to present, you know, both his life and the story, the film itself, because the film itself is a creation that comes out of him. It's not his creation specifically, but it is what people recognize and connect to. And I think it's, and that is what I think. And so it was a decision about how do we, and also the story in the book itself, because the visuals from the book, I think, are which was this wonderful discovery for me, was how beautiful the imagery, the illustrations that are, you know, by Denslow in the 1900 book that came out. So then we knew we had a lot of visuals to work with, and we wanted to make sure, you figure out how do you weave those together? You know, if you wait, and there was discussion, do we actually just follow the chronological biography and really don't introduce the story of the Wizard of Oz until it actually happens in his life? And we were playing around with that structure, and then, you know, and we were also working, and we were also experimenting with the structure of what we ended up in the final film, which is sort of interweaving, you know, pieces of the story told both through the book and the film as the actual film progresses. And those touched upon themes and other aspects of his life, it may not have been just, you know, more about the story, that were not specifically chronological and connected to him.
I think that was a really good choice. It's presumptuous of me to tell you did a good job on something, but I really, as just an ordinary person viewing the film, I really think that was great, that the story of the Wizard of Oz is not addressed only 1 hour and 40 minutes in or whatever, but that it is artfully woven in as we experience certain chapters in Mr. Baum's life, at which would suggest a connection to certain elements in the story. That's a really, really a wonderful decision, I think, that you both made.
We're glad to hear that. At one point we tried it the other way and it was so dull.
Well, it would be a lot of disappointing, just a lot of disappointment, a lot of gray prairie, a lot of setbacks and so on. And in a sense, the joy and the life of the Wizard of Oz, having that interspersed gives it a different kind of color and flavor. Before we dig into Mr. Baum's story, a final kind of preliminary question. You made the decision to start the film in what I think is a really interesting way. And it takes us right there to the film version, which so many of us know and love, which I think we're told in your film is the most seen film of all time and the most repeatedly viewed film of all time. But anyway, your film begins with the movie version, but in a particular way. Explain to our listeners how your documentary starts.
Go ahead, Randy. You
okay,
can take
sure.
It.
So yeah, so the documentary starts with the first broadcast of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz on American television, which is November 3rd, 1956. And it was a seminal event, I think, both in terms of television and certainly for the and also for the story itself. I mean, you had 45 million viewers across the country tuning in to the same station, the same film at the same time, which of course, you know, today that really doesn't happen if anybody tunes into their TVs at all, as opposed to, you know, their device or streaming something and so on. And so I think this is what was important, because that was really the beginning, what really cemented the story in the American consciousness. So it was really kind of laying the groundwork for, you know, what people today understand about the Wizard of Oz. And then you peel back away and reveal that behind this was this man. And this man who actually was this incredible person who really was sort of lived a life of reinvention and creating his own future for himself, which, you know, is an American story. You know, he did come from a, you know, a privileged background, but he certainly had his struggles and he had his many failures before he was able to finally land upon writing children's stories, which of course became very successful for him. And then he became a very, you know, I mean, the amount, voracious writer. I mean, he wrote a lot of work beyond The Wizard of Oz. We don't get into that in the film, but he was, you know, he was somebody who loved to write, and he was able to finally make that work for him as a career. And so anyway, I kind of went beyond your question. So I'll leave it at that.
Absolutely great. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Randall McLowry and Tracy Heather Strain about the film that they wrote, directed, and produced together, a film called American Oz, The True Wizard Behind the Curtain, which is airing this Monday night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country as part of the series American Experience. It explores the complicated life of L. Frank Baum, a complicated man. As you've just touched on, Randall McLowry, L. Frank Baum's life began in very idyllic fashion. I mean, I think the film spells it out that his was an idyllic childhood as the son of loving, wealthy parents who gave him all kinds of things that every child wants as part of their childhood. And yet he was not content to simply follow in his father's footsteps, but had other aspirations. I'm kind of curious, how do we know so much about L. Frank Baum on that really deeply personal level? Is some of this kind of educated guesswork or surmising from outward evidence that of some of his hopes and dreams and aspirations, or does he leave behind him some kind of legacy that makes all of that very clear?
Do you want me to take that, Tracy, or do you?
Yeah, go. You can start.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, Baum, you know, as a writer, you know, he did leave his legacy of what he wrote, and most of that is fiction, and most of that is, oftentimes, you know, fiction for children, young adults. In terms of personal writings, there's not a lot to rely on. I mean, he did do other, there's letters and so on that we do lean upon, but there's no journals and sort of that personal writing that we can kind of get inside his head to understand, you know, motivations in a very distinct way. But, you know, I think it is, there's great evidence in terms of his sense of, from a young age, wanting to write and sort of being drawn into that world of imagination and the world of fairy tales. And he does write later in life about the importance of fairy tales, both I think about for himself, but also I think in general for why he thinks they're important. And also his ideas about fairy tales. And in the introduction of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, he talks about how he wanted to create a modern fairy tale, one that wasn't about heartaches and, you know, nightmares, but was something that was more optimistic. So I think there's those kinds of things that we're able to get. And we can just see through the kinds of work that he chooses to do that it is focused on a sense of creativity. He, you know, he wants to get involved with raising chickens, but not just any kinds of chickens, but fancy fowl, you know, fancy poultry, which is part of a craze that was had on the time. And he writes about it, and he has pamphlets that are very, you know, wonderfully written and poetic about sort of these birds that, and he comes quite well. And certain thing about him, I think he does research because he became very well versed in this topic and this subject. Then he gets involved with acting. He gets involved with not only performing, but he wants to write. He wants to produce. He wants to tell stories.
One of the things I was going to add, though, is that, you know, when we worked on the film about Lorraine Hansberry, we did have her diaries and journals and things. And other papers and her ex-late husband Robert Nemiroff had people send in things. Unfortunately, I remember the day when Rebecca Taylor called us, the other producer, to say that unfortunately she learned that Maud Baum had burned a lot of his papers or most of his papers. So we don't know what was in them. We don't know if there were there would have been more material that would give us a direct idea of what he was thinking. And so in this film, we were very careful, sort of to get back to your question in a specific way, of not trying to say that Baum did this and this is exactly why The Wizard of Oz is this way, because right. we don't know what he was thinking for sure. And like Randy pointed out, these are children's books. And so there are people who make a lot of, have come up with schemes about, or ideas about how The Wizard of Oz represents this or that, but we stayed away from that because we don't feel, we don't have anything to back that up, that right. thinking up.
Yeah, and I do appreciate the fact that you present what you present in ways that are very, very clear and in a sense do not overstep the bounds. But I think you are very persuasive in what you present about Mr. Baum and his life and his life choices, which really give us a sense of who he was and what made him tick. I think one of the most interesting chapters in the film is when you talk about when this elaborate and ambitious touring company in which he is the star and the producer and the scenery designer and so on goes on tour, and then things kind of fall apart and he has to come back home and gets a job from his dad in the family oil business. And the way he goes about selling his father's axle grease really speaks to the creative spirit that was within mm-hmm. him. Tell our listeners just a little bit about what I'm talking about.
Sure. So Frank Baum's father, Benjamin Baum, made his fortune in the oil fields of Pennsylvania and New York. So the first oil boom in America. And so he got in early and made a lot of money. And that's the main thing that really kind of built the wealth that Frank Baum enjoyed as a child. And out of that work in the oil business, Frank's brother, older brother, who I think was actually a chemist, got involved with creating a new axle grease. And this was primarily used for things on wagons and horses and carts and things like that. And it was very necessary part of the American economy at that time in a rising industrial world. And so Frank, you know, comes back home and he gets this job, and he basically, his main job is he's the superintendent who's dealing with sales, and he's doing both print ads and things like that, and actually going out on the road trying to sell it. But he really tries to find an inventive, humorous, and kind of has a hook to trying to get people to want to check out this oil and buy this oil. It's very colorful ads that he has, and it has a little story to it about, you know, if and he talks about in one where there's a bunch of less, for a bit lack of a better words, or rural kids and man in a kind of rundown cart racing past this fancy sort of dandy you know, with his horse and buggy, and the kids are thumbing their nose at him and telling him, well, if you had Baum's Castorine, you'd be able to go faster in your cart. And so it's kind of like understanding, you know, kind of human nature and what things people would be interested, or how they want, why they might choose to want to buy axle grease from Baum's Castorine. And which actually is a small note, it's not related to the family anymore, but Baum's Castorine is still a company that does exist.
Wow.
It's been sold, you know, back in the, you know, late 19th century, you know, but it did retain itself, and it still is a company that is out there. Hmm.
I think one of the really fascinating parts of this whole story is when you, in a sense, take us along with L. Frank Baum and his wife and young children as they move themselves out to the prairie, specifically to Aberdeen, South Dakota, which was an amazing boom town at the time. And and the way that L. Frank Baum goes about trying to make a difference in this community is really quite extraordinary. Can you just explain a little bit about what drew him to the prairie, to want to live someplace sure. that at a glance would seem like the middle of nowhere?
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of white Americans were looking to the West. in terms of new lives and new identities. And it, you know, was presented as a place that was open and free to become whatever you wanted to become. And many people from the Syracuse area were already out there in Aberdeen, including relatives. And so during one of his sales trips, Frank stopped in to visit his brother-in-law. And I guess it seems to have gotten him thinking about it, because he wrote him after he got back and said, you know, in your country, I think I can be somebody. And so he was drawn into it, and they packed up and moved out to Aberdeen.
One of the things I love about this story, in terms of all that he did in Aberdeen, was the creation of this wonderful store, Baum's Bazaar. And I'm so glad that you take the time that you do to describe this amazing place, and help us understand how amazing it was for this to be in Aberdeen, South Dakota, of all places. But and at one point, I think in the film, the line is shared, the store is a stage. That is, this store opened by L. Frank Baum was, in a sense, a kind of store that also probably offers up kind of a window into his soul and into what was most important for him. Tell our listeners about Baum's Bazaar.
So Baum's Bazaar was basically a luxury store or a novelty store in the middle of the prairie. He was emulating, the department stores who were rising in places like Chicago, the Marshall Fields, or a store he specifically references called the Fair. It had all these items, these goods. And at that time, sort of the consumer culture was starting to rise in America. And, you know, the people were able to sort of create their identities through goods, which is very much a part of America today. And Baum, when he was out visiting his brother-in-law, he was looking around, he was thinking about what his future might be and what it would be like in this place. And he basically put on his business person hat and, well, this place has lots of dry goods, you know, feed stores and dry goods stores, but doesn't have something that would, you know, capture the imagination of this growing metropolis, which they believed would become the next Minneapolis or Kansas City or Chicago. And so he felt like this was a need, this was a niche that he could fill. And so he was very methodical, and he had purchased a lot of goods, and he got out there, and within 2 weeks he opens up this store and this grand opening, and promising every lady attending a box of chocolates from Chicago. And it really was this place that was represented, I think, in terms of his own imagination, you know, his sense of, but also in viewing, you know, these objects with sort of this value and this sense of bringing a sense of uniqueness to their lives by being able to purchase these things and bringing joy. And I think that was a lot of part of what he wanted to do. He wanted to make people happy in many different ways. And he thought this would help. And he thought also that this would be a way that he could make money and sustain his family, which up to that point was sort of, in some ways, I think was kind of always weighing on him, you know. And certainly we talk about in the film that his mother-in-law was always worried that he would not be able to do that because of his, you know, he wasn't embarking into professions that necessarily would provide the support that would maintain that support for a family.
Right.
But in another way, it's a fascinating story, because on the one hand, he was methodical and he was, you know, he loved being there. He told kids stories there. It was he liked the idea of making it kind of a center of town. But on the other hand, we are in the midst of it's a prairie town, and mostly farmers are surrounding, and so as you know in the film, the weather, a drought comes. Who's going to buy fancy goods in a drought when eating is going to be the priority, right?
Yeah.
So you know, he just happened to hit it a period of time where there wasn't a drought, right? He wasn't thinking ahead about what do I do if bad times come. I don't think that was necessarily how he thought.
Right. Ever the optimist. And I think your film comes as close as we can possibly come to understanding what this amazing store was like, And even though I'm sure no photographs exist of what it looked like inside, but I think you do a wonderful job of kind of recreating the sense of wonder that one had to have when you walked through the doors and experienced this. But as you've already hinted at, this awful drought, the worst that America had ever seen, leads to the store having to shut down, and Mr. Baum turns his attention to writing. One of the things you touch on in this chapter of the film is that this is also a very turbulent period in terms of the displacement of Native Americans from their own land, and things become very tense and painful at certain points. And we're presented with the really unhappy reality of Mr. Baum having some of his own ideas about Native Americans turning very dark and twisted. We'll leave it to our listeners to experience it thoroughly in the film, but could you just say a word about what it was like to have to deal with this kind of unhappy side of who L. Frank Baum was, and what you thought about in terms of trying to present this as fairly as you could?
So I think, and this obviously, you know, I think is part of what we, you know, in terms of thinking about him as a complicated person, you know, he does have some very hurtful and unfathomable words that he writes about Native Americans around the time of Wounded Knee, which was a very dark period in American history. And, you know, I think our approach is understanding the context of the times and understanding where he comes from in terms of his own background and what was seen as, you know, his ideas about Native Americans was not unique. His idea about Native Americans was actually probably much more prevalent in terms of how society or white society viewed Native Americans and, you know, the ideas of extermination and, you know, he's looking at, in terms of how you sort of think about what his choices were in terms of what he wrote. I mean, he wrote two editorials that were unspeakable in many respects. And so while he was echoing thoughts that were part of the American ideology, or at least the white American ideology at the time, I mean, these are obviously things that he, you know, bought into. And while he was in many ways progressive in his attitudes towards women and spoke about tolerance in his newspaper and how he saw America as a tolerant place, he you know, didn't associate that with Native Americans.
Yeah, and we also see that this is the American experience, you know. I mean, not literally because the program, but this is who we are as Americans. And I think the sooner we all embrace the realities of who we are as a country, who we have been, we're never going to ever change. If we want to, you can't sit back with your head in the sand and deny that this person didn't say that, or they didn't mean this, you know, oh, you're reading it wrong. That's not helpful. And we can't apologize for people. It's important to say people are, as you said, complicated, and people are cultures of their time, but that doesn't like take them off the hook, you know, because as Randy's pointed out, he was tolerant about some things, but then, you know, when economic interests hit or self-interest hit, you know, sometimes that's when people show who they are, at least certain aspects of who they are. So I think it wasn't like a hard decision or anything to include. It would have been, I think, a terrible decision not to include it.
I quite agree. I appreciate the frankness and honesty with which you'd address this. You also don't rush past it. You also don't, it seems to me at least, you don't unduly dwell on it. I mean, this is one part of who he was, but it does not consume, in a sense, all of who he was. There were other things about him of more admirable characteristics, and I think you are completely fair and open as you try to help us understand this man and his complications. We're speaking with Randall McLowry, and Tracy Heather Strain about American Oz, The True Wizard Behind the Curtain, a fascinating documentary about L. Frank Baum, which airs this Monday night on PBS stations across the country. So when things eventually kind of fall apart out on the prairie for Mr. Baum and his family, they resettle in the amazing city of Chicago. And I so appreciate the time that your film takes to describe Chicago at this point in time. And in particular, the amazing Chicago World's Fair that opens in 1893. Just briefly say a word about how this seems to have been a tremendous source of inspiration for L. Frank Baum when he, some years later, writes The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Yes, so the World's Fair was an incredible moment, and certainly what it presented. I mean, it was, at the time, you know, it was probably one of the most visited and most talked about events, certainly in America, and if not the world at that time. And I'd have to go back, but you know, millions of people showed up for the opening, and it was, or a quarter of a million people showed up for the opening. I should double check my, I should know that off the top of my head, but I'd have to go back and look at the script to clarify my exact, the exact number. But it really was presenting, and I think what was really captivating for somebody like Baum was this, the imagination and sort of the amazing new inventions that were being presented there, things, the electricity building, you know, somebody like Thomas Edison, who was, you know, also called the Wizard of Menlo Park. This was a transformative time in American history. I mean, it was also a moment that was also trumpeting sort of the rise of America as a power, both in terms of within the United States, but also as a world power, and sort of presenting sort of the rise of Western civilization. But I think, you know, for Baum, there was a sense of possibilities that were presented there, a sense of, you know, things to come in the future. And I think it really, you know, ignited his imagination to think about that. And you know, we do talk about that, while we don't know for definitively, but, you know, the World's Fair was known as the White City because it was these beautiful neoclassical buildings that were all painted white and just sort of had this sort of glow to it. And the idea that there was this almost this, the ideal city, this sort of not necessarily utopia, but and Oz, the Emerald City in Oz, is seen as potentially as a as an inspiration from what was presented at Chicago's World's Fair and the White City. And so those kinds of senses of imagination of possibilities are the things that I think really drew Frank Baum into that moment and into that world, into the World's Fair. And I think it gave him that sense of, you know, reaching beyond sort of, you know, what your everyday world is, and to see things beyond that.
Right. Reaching beyond the ordinary, which right. Of course he very much did. In a sense, though, when it came time to actually sit down and do some writing and try to achieve success as a writer, your film tells us that it was, in a sense, for the most ordinary of reasons that L. Frank Baum wanted this for himself, and it had a lot to do with his family. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, by the time he was writing for children, he had four kids, and he was on the road a lot, and he would come home and tell them stories and to entertain them, to be with them. And his mother-in-law, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, encouraged him to write those stories down. She was published, and she had a sense that, you know, he could do something with these great stories that he was spinning for his children.
And it would be a way to not be on the road as an exhausted right. traveling salesman. I mean, I just love that, in a sense, it was for such a ordinary kind of reason that he ended up sitting down and doing this.
But I also think that the fact that he was out there traveling and seeing the country, you know, I think that it provided him with, in essence, you know, grist for his imagination, and seeing these different people and seeing these different landscapes. And certainly he had, you know, the landscape of the prairie obviously informed the Wonderful Wizard of Oz in the first chapter, and you know, the world of Kansas and sort of the and the drought that he witnessed out on in Dakota, you know, was a was very directly an inspiration for the Kansas that Dorothy grew up in. But I think it also sort of, we kind of imagine sort of the idea that when you're, you know, on a train and things are passing by, that's kind of like, it allows your imagination to sort of continue. We don't know that that's necessarily how he did, but he, the idea that he was in hotels and he would be writing things down on every little pieces of paper. He was just kind of constantly, I think, being bombarded with new places and new faces and, you know, different experiences that then I think led him into things like with the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which was this creation of great different groups of people and different types of people. And Dorothy's journey is a world of discovery of different and encountering different people on her way, trying to get back home, which of course, if, you know, if you look at Frank Baum and his effort to want to get back home and to be at home, you can, you know, see sort of connections between his life and what he does translate into that story.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was going to add about the train when you are just jumped in with that. It's like, we used to ride the train a lot. We used to live in Boston. We rode the Northeast Corridor trains a lot. And I've even ridden the trains out to the Midwest at times, like right after 9/11, when the planes were grounded, I actually took a train trip to out in the Midwest. And you know, it used to be before everyone had a laptop, you would sit there and you'd look out and you would think. And I remember getting a lot of work done and writing down on the train. We imagined that that was the case before. And and so if you will notice that in the film, there's a lot of train. I mean, that was a major way of transportation, of course, but there's something about that rhythm and the changing scenery. And I do recall that a few years ago, Amtrak had started a program, you know, so that people, writers could like, right across the country. You know, there's something about that movement and writing and thinking that we wanted to capture in this film.
Well, you certainly did. And of course, with the publication of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum finally achieves the notable and sort of unique success that he had been so hungry for. And of course, there's a plethora of sequels, as well as a stage musical version that opens in 1902. I'm so glad you tell us a little bit about that and even share a few snatches of music from that largely forgotten moment. But that is another way in which this wonderful story sort of works its way into the hearts and lives of people all across the country. And of course, eventually, other ways in which this world expands in such spectacular fashion. I think you've done a marvelous job of telling a really complicated story. And L. Frank Baum's story, in a sense, is America's story as well. We are all a part of what he saw and experienced. The film, again, is titled American Oz, The True Wizard Behind the Curtain. It airs on PBS stations across the country this Monday evening, April 19th, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And this film written, directed, and produced by Randall McLowry and Tracy Heather Strain. My congrats to both of you for an absolutely wonderful film. And my thanks to you for being part of The Morning Show today. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you so much. We're so delighted you liked the film, and we hope your viewers love it as well.
Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure to speak with you.
Monday on The Morning Show, we'll celebrate National Poetry Month by replaying my conversation with the editor of a book called The Spoken Word Revolution, Slam, Hip Hop, and the Poetry of a New Generation, a book which includes a companion CD with marvelous examples of groundbreaking modern poetry. Tuesday's Morning Show will include the author of The Cigarette Century, The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. On Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program. On Thursday, a look at an exciting project in Walworth County, and a grant which will allow mental health professionals to accompany police officers on certain crisis calls in which mental health issues might be a factor. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is also available as a podcast 7 days a week through Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast, any major podcast platform provider. Be sure that you look for the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's exactly 9 o'clock.